All right, so next we have Dr. Matthew Bott, who attends at Memorial Sloan Kettering. His focus is on thoracic oncology, but he's also got an interest in minimal invasive surgery as well as benign esophageal diseases. So Matt is going to talk to us about molecular techniques in lung cancer. Tiny topic.
All right, well, thanks for having me. My name is Matthew Bott. I'm an attending at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I have the privilege of talking to you for a few minutes this morning in regard to molecular correlates for the classification of lung cancer, and I'm specifically really going to focus on adenocarcinoma. Just a brief disclosure, I've consulted with AstraZeneca in regard to locally advanced lung cancer, but nothing that really applies to this particular talk. So as we mentioned, this is a pretty broad topic. I thought I would sort of focus on three things. First, just give an overview based on TCGA of what the mutational landscape in adenocarcinoma looks like. I'll talk about some more recent insights in regard to predicting response from checkpoint inhibition, which is a hot topic these days. And then a personal research interest of mine, which is looking for genomic correlates of the IASLC subtypes. So as far as the background, the initial profiling studies really have provided a number of insights into the molecular events that drive lung cancer formation. As such, the lung adenocarcinoma has really become sort of the poster child of precision medicine, as we have a number of targeted therapies that are really tailored toward these oncogenic events. And now with the dawn of immunotherapy, we've really expanded the scope of interest beyond those things into genomic events that sort of drive tumor immune evasion, and can we identify events that predict response to some of these agents. So most of the initial characterization was done as part of the TCGA initiative, Cancer Genome Atlas. So they looked at 230 resected adenocarcinomas and subjected them to a number of profiling panels, exome sequencing, copy number analysis, transcriptional profiling, and methylation. These are the main figures from that study. So this sort of reinforces what we currently understand about lung cancer, which is that about half of cases had a P53 inactivation. KRAS was the most frequently activated oncogene in about 30% of cases, EGFR mutations in about 10 to 15%, and that varies greatly based on the population that you're studying. And then sort of a smattering of tumor suppressor mutations, KEAP1, STK11, NF1, et cetera. The fortunate news for patients is that now a number of these oncogenic drivers are amenable to targeted therapy. So, for instance, MET, ERBB2, ROS1, ALK, BRAF, and EGFR all have small molecule inhibitors that that are clinically available. So part of that TCGA analysis was trying to classify these tumors based on the genomics, and they did that in a number of ways. First of all, they used expression profiling to classify them into three subtypes, which I show on the left there: proximal proliferative, proximal inflammatory, and then terminal respiratory unit. They then layer on top of that another degree of classification based on methylation, so low, intermediate, and high methylation. You can see in these subtypes across the top, 1 through 6, sort of incorporate that expression profile and the methylation profile into these subcategories. Now, I think while this is interesting from a scientific point of view and philosophically is interesting, it really doesn't portend too much clinically in terms of patient care, at least at the moment. So moving forward, how can we do better? One way is to identify additional targets. Remember, about 25% of tumors don't have any identifiable driver, so there's a lot of research in terms of clarifying what are the abnormalities that give rise to those tumors. Another area I would say of intense research and something we've also been interested in is targeted therapy for RAS mutant cancer, which currently does not exist. And then additionally, beyond oncogenic drivers, are there particular tumor suppressors that we can identify that have an impact on prognosis and potentially response to treatment? I'll talk with you a little bit about that in a minute. And lastly, can we create maybe novel classification schemes that may improve our understanding of the disease? So again, T-cell checkpoint inhibitors have really revolutionized the treatment of lung cancer at this point. We see long-term disease control in a subset of patients. Unfortunately, this is the minority of patients. Response rate's about 20%, but many of these are fairly durable over time. So the most commonly used method for predicting response is PD-L1 expression. However, that's somewhat unreliable, and you can see in the Kaplan-Meier curve in the upper right, this is from the KEYNOTE-001 study, that if you had a PD-L1 expression rate over 50%, you were much likely to have a survival benefit following pembrolizumab therapy than patients with low expression. However, the waterfall plot on the bottom right is from an induction study of nivolumab that we performed recently with Johns Hopkins, which showed that even in patients that were PD-L1 negative, a subset of them still had a major pathologic response, meaning more than 90% tumor killing at the time of resection. So that sort of implies that PD-L1 is part of the story, but that there's clearly other things that play into it, and we need to do a better job of elucidating exactly what those are. So this is a subsequent study from our institution looking at a cohort of 240 patients that received targeted PD-L1 therapy and also underwent genomic profiling. And one of the things that they found was most prognostic is something called tumor mutation burden. So in other words, how many mutations are in your tumor were associated with a response. And you can see in the bar graph on the left that as you went up in percentile of mutations, your response rate increased sort of in kind. And then they found that when you combine that with PD-L1 staining, the results were even better. So if you looked at the group that was tumor mutation burden high and PD-L1 high, their response rate was 50%. Whereas if you looked at tumor mutation burden low, PD-L1 low, the rate dropped to 18%. So it seemed like incorporating both of those was really better than either alone. Now, I'll tell you that these are still in the process of being incorporated into clinical algorithms. We don't really know exactly how to integrate all of this at the moment, but I think these sort of things are promising. The other thing they tried to do in that study was look specifically at particular mutations to see if there were mutations that were associated with better or worse response. This is really hard to read. I apologize, but the take-home point is that activating mutations in EGFR predicted poor response, and that's not necessarily surprising because these are generally tumors in non-smoking or minimal smoking patients that have low tumor mutation burden, and you wouldn't necessarily expect them to respond well to immune checkpoint inhibitors. More surprisingly, inactivating mutations in a tumor suppressor called SDK11 were actually much more frequent in patients that did not respond. This was validated in a subsequent study published earlier this year, and what they found was in 66 patients who had PD-L1 treatment and mutational profiling, SDK11 or LKB1 mutations were much more common in patients who had a high tumor mutation burden but low PD-L1 staining. And what they found was in that PD-L1 low subgroup, if you had an SDK11 mutation, you were much less likely to respond to checkpoint inhibition than if you had wild-type protein. Similarly, the survival curve from that study further validated that, where your overall survival with wild-type SDK11 was far superior to those with mutated protein. So I think, again, you're going to see more and more of these studies looking particularly at individual genetic events and how they impact response to treatment, because we clearly have a long way to go in terms of predicting this well. So lastly, I'm going to talk for a few minutes about some work that we've been interested in. I'll stress that this is really preliminary data, but I think it's pretty thought-provoking in terms of genomic correlates of histologic classification. So as many of you may or may not know, the IASLC and the WHO break down lung adenocarcinoma into 5 histologic subtypes: lipidic, papillary, micropapillary, solid, and acinar. Interestingly, these aren't just patterns on a slide. They do actually have importance in regard to tumor behavior and prognosis for patients. So 2 subtypes in particular, the micropapillary and the solid, are associated with a much higher rate of recurrence and increased mortality. And you can see from the graph on the left that if you have more than 5% of micropapillary in your tumor, your rate of incidence, your rate of recurrence following resection is much higher. Similarly, in the graph on the right, if you have even a small percentage of solid within your tumor, your recurrence-free survival is significantly diminished following treatment. So our questions are these differences in phenotype and tumor behavior driven by underlying genetic changes? And can we identify the genes associated with these aggressive subtypes? And would that provide us with information regarding tumor biology? And can we potentially use that for treatment purposes? So to investigate this first, we went back to the TCGA data, which is publicly available, and we sort of reanalyzed it according to histologic subtype. The histologic subtype is annotated in the TCGA, but it's not ideal, and I'll talk about that more in a second. When we looked at the mutational spectrum from one subtype to another, there were some relatively weak associations. For instance, EGFR was overrepresented in lipidic and acinar tumors, But this was by no means pathognomonic, so I think there was a lot more that we needed to do to clarify this. So what are the issues with the TCGA in regard to investigating this? So 80% of lung cancers, adenocarcinoma at least, are a mix of subtypes. So in other words, you could have three or four different subtypes within your given tumor, and even if you have a small percentage of one, it could really impact your prognosis. Within the TCGA, the tumors are annotated according to subtype. However, this is a multi-institutional study, so the subtype information is not validated, and it only records the dominant subtype. In other words, what the most frequently represented portion was. Now, if that was 30, 40%, or 90%, it all gets essentially recorded the same way. So we thought maybe we could drill down on this a little better using our MSK Impact platform. So this is a next-gen sequencing panel that looks at 468 cancer-related genes, and we've now performed this on thousands of resected and even metastatic lung cancer cases. And our goal was to identify a population of tumors that are relatively homogeneous. So we tried to find tumors that were basically 75% or more of a particular subtype, and that's all coded in our pathology reports by our pathologist. We were going to look at mutational data as well as copy number, which you can also derive from the impact data, and the goal is to analyze genomic events that are recurrent in these poor prognostic subtypes. Overall, we identified 139 tumors, and you can see the distribution there. Not all of the subtypes are equally represented, and they're our reasons for that, the micropapillary and the papillary, it's very unusual to find those as dominant subtypes within a tumor. They tend to be fairly small components, but we did manage to find about a handful of each of those. So the first analysis was to plot mutation count by copy number. So mutation count along the y-axis and copy number along the x-axis. And what you see, I think, is sort of recapitulates what we see clinically. So the blue dots here are lipidic, which is sort of an indolent, even pre-malignant lesion, and they all sort of cluster down here in the left lower corner of the graph. The intermediate subtypes would be the papillary and the acinar. You can see there's a little bit more irregularity, but then as you go to the more aggressive subtypes, micropapillary and solid, you do see much more both in the way of mutational abnormality as well as copy number variation. So then we tried to look specifically at mutations that may or may not be overrepresented in relative subtypes. So interestingly, we think that KRAS and EGFR are sort of initiating events, and the frequency of alteration there was fairly equal amongst the subtypes. But then as you look more into tumor suppressors, the frequency varied quite a bit. So in other words, in lipidic, the rate of P53 inactivation is quite low, whereas in micropapillary and papillary, it's quite high. Oops, hold on 1 second. In addition, there were particular tumor suppressor abnormalities that were somewhat unique to some of these subtypes. So in other words, STK11, we talked about before, was present in about 75% of papillary, and KEAP1 was another one that was really overrepresented in terms of the papillary subgroup. Now, again, that's a very fairly small group of tumors, but we're encouraged by this data, and we're looking into this a little bit more. This is sort of hard to see also, but I told you that we can generate copy number variation based on that impact panel, and this is what the data looks like. I promise it looks better than this, actually. But in any case, 139 tumors with copy numbers shown sort of in columns and chromosomes 1, 2, 3, 4 as you go all the way down. Blue indicates a loss of DNA in that region, and red is a gain. So there does seem to be some variability, and we're looking into integrating this with our mutational data to try and provide some additional information. Other things that we have going, so I mentioned that these tumors are heterogeneous, so can we microdissect the various subtypes within a tumor and profile those separately to see if there's genetic heterogeneity there? And can we use exome sequencing, which we're in the process of doing, to try and perform phylogenetic analysis to see maybe some of these more indolent subtypes give rise to more aggressive ones, or do they arise independently of one another, et cetera? Someone told me it's hard to get a grant funded these days without including something about single-cell sequencing. So we're in the process of trying to incorporate this into our research plan as well, and basically this allows you to look at transcriptional profiles of individual cells within a tumor, and you can profile both cancer cells, stromal cells, inflammatory cells, all of these things. The technology basically involves running cells through a fluidics chamber, so dissociating the tumor and flowing cells through this chamber, where each cell gets encapsulated in a droplet, and within the droplet is a microbead, and the cells get lysed, and the RNA gets captured on the bead. It gets reverse transcribed with a barcode and then sequenced in bulk so that you can identify which barcodes are associated with a particular cell and create cell-specific transcription profiles. So we're very interested in doing this and seeing how those profiles vary from one subtype to another. So a lot of this work is ongoing, but I would like to thank my colleagues in the Department of Surgery as well as our colleagues in pathology, a number of folks in my lab that support this research, and my funding as well. So thank you very much.
Question. So are any of these markers ever detectable through cell-free DNA?
Yeah, so that's, I was going to include something about that, but I didn't in the interest of time. But we have a very active cell-free DNA program. And I think the takeaway is that the technology is good at this point for looking at metastatic disease in patients with a high tumor burden. If we try and use it in early-stage patients or resected patients, it doesn't work quite as well. You do see a signal periodically, but it's not reliable enough, I don't think, at least with the technology, the way that it stands, to use it routinely. So I think as time goes on, you know, and the technology improves, you'll probably hear more about it. But I think for the moment, it's still pretty experimental. But
any questions from the audience? So do you, or this is also maybe for Dennis, are we at the point where we should get rid of histology and just go with molecular analysis? You know, you've both shown some pretty compelling data that we consider histology as the gold standard, but really, if there are differences in histology, if you see a poorly differentiated cancer where you can't tell what the histology is, should we be going to their molecular profiling to determine what their subsequent care should be driven?
You answer in a while.
I think it's an interesting question. I don't think histology will ever really go away, but I could certainly see revisions of the staging system that incorporate more molecular data. And I think that's sort of where we're going with this type of work. And I think, again, the possibility is there. In practicality, the information is not quite to the point where we can use it for that purpose. But I would say in the future, without a doubt, you know, some aspects of these things, particularly in response to treatment, you know, things that are predictive, I think that'll end up being really important. But I don't know that we'll ever totally abandon histology, but it's going to get more complicated in terms of the genomics, yeah.
I agree with the complication piece.
But I don't think you're ever going to get completely rid of histology. Like, I think that's going to be the first pass. But the key is going to be, how do you integrate the molecular information with that? I mean, if you do your first pass, and yes, it is an adeno in the lung, and yes, it's got micropapillary features, as we know more and more, the key then is going to be all the splitting that comes from knowing the genomic correlates given that histology. So I don't think it's going away, but yes, the world is going to get more complicated.